This week on the Training Science Podcast, we hear from a real leader in our area of sports science, medicine, and coaching, Dr. Marco Cardinale. Now, Marco has an extensive history in our field, starting back in 1993, where he was coaching across a variety of different sports over time, ranging from handball to volleyball to track and field. This work then eventually progresses to a tenure with the highly successful Team GB in the Beijing, Vancouver, and London Games, where Marco led the science integration into coalface practice. We speak about this rich history, lessons learned along the way, and Marco's coaching and teaching philosophy that he now holds as a result of this. There was also lots of discussion on the surging area of AI and what today's practitioners should be considering as they work on their own professional development. And for this, Marco puts his money where his mouth is, as he isn't finished discovering things for himself, now training for triathlon and tinkering with technologies that are emerging all along the way. So it was a super insightful conversation with another legend in our field that I know you're going to enjoy. So without further ado, I now bring you Marco Cardinale.
Hello and welcome to the Training Science Podcast. I'm Paul Larson.
And I am Martin Buscheid.
And we're excited to be your hosts. Together, we're going to be exploring both the science of training and its application in sport.
We've spent the last 20 years researching and applying the science at the coalface of high-performance sport, from elite clubs, professional athletes, and Olympic programs.
But it's going to be here on the Training Science Podcast that we're going to take that experience and provide you with what my colleague Martin likes to call a no-bullshit approach to how we apply the science in the real world.
And because the context always matters more than the content.
So let's get into today's podcast.
I'm here with Marco Cardinale. Marco, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me. And I'm a big follower of your podcast, so it's great to be involved in this. And maybe I will be listening to myself in the next few weeks on my long bike rides indoor.
Oh, yeah. We got to talk about that. I think that's pretty cool that you're into the triathlon sort of stuff. And that's a pastime. We'll get into that. But mate, you know, you're one of those people that is, it's pretty exciting to have you on because you come with such rich background. You've been around the traps for a little while, mate. And maybe I'd love it if you wouldn't mind just telling us a little bit about your background and when it all started and what you're up to today.
Well, thanks for telling me I'm old. joking aside, this is a bit like an archaeological dig now. But no, I had my first degree in 93. And then for the youngsters that are on the podcast, the internet was just being invented in Italy around 93, 94. And my first degree was in sports science. In Italy, it was called motor sciences at the time. But there were no postgraduate degrees in Italy. So the only chance for me to further my education was to go abroad. I was very fortunate to get a scholarship in the US to do my master. So I did my master in Alabama, and then I came back to Europe working with professional teams and federations in Italy. But I wanted to do my PhD. Again, there was no opportunity to do it in Italy at the time. So I did a part-time PhD in Budapest, at Semmelweis University, or now it's called its TF, with Professor Bosco, which was my supervisor, together with Professor Josef Tihani. But then I really wanted to learn how to do science properly and get a proper academic job. So I left for Scotland in 2001, did 4 years until 2005 there. At the same time, while I was in Scotland, I was consulting for the US Professional Volleyball League, which had 1 year only in 2000. They made an attempt to professionalize volleyball post-college, unfortunately failed and folded after. But I had a great opportunity there for 1 year to work. But then I was missing athletes. I was spending a lot of time doing proper science, as some of my colleagues used to say, with the animal models and learning about memory and learning with exercise. But I was missing the gyms, the athletes. And so an opportunity came in London with the British Olympic Association at the time in the Olympic Medical Institute in Northwick Park. I accepted the job in January 2005. And then before I actually moved to start. London got the bid for the Olympics in 2012. So that was, I was very fortunate to be in the right time, in the right moment, getting that job. And then a lot of things changed over the years while I was there. And as part of my role with the British Olympic Association, I then changed from research manager to head of sports science and research. And in that role, I did 3 Olympic Games with Team GB, 2 summer and 2 winter games. So the summer games were Beijing and London, and the winter games were the Vancouver Olympics in 2010. Post-London, things changed. I left for joining Aspire Academy in 2013 as head of sports physiology and research until 2020. And then in 2020, I moved to Aspetar Hospital as executive director of research and scientific support. But I was very fortunate. I think I had a fantastic time in the UK at a moment where UK sport and sports science was really moving forward. I was fortunate to be part of a fantastic community of practitioners and a buzzing environment to really try a lot of innovation and a lot of things. And I was exposed to work with 26 summer sports and 7 winter sports. So I've seen a lot of things over the years. And now I moved in the last few years in a research role, but mostly in an hospital environment. So I'm not dealing with performance issues now. I'm dealing with athletes that are broken and trying to make them recover faster from a variety of injuries. So I've been exposed in my career to a lot of things, I would say, in the world of sport.
Man, you sure have. It's incredible. Yeah. And you kind of glossed over, but you've even got like coaching background as well, right? So like, I love how your background, you've just sort of seen it all from, I think you were a failed athlete too, right?
Yeah. I was a handball player, not a particularly good one. I played up to second league in Italy, second division. And I got my coaching badges very early. So I was coaching first handball athletes, but I also had coaching badges in athletics and gymnastics and swimming. So in the summer, I was a swim coach because they made good earning. And then in the winter, I would be coaching some athletics, but also coaching handball. And I coached, I think to this day, I'm still probably the only Italian that has coached a foreign national team in handball. I was head coach for the British team in 2003. And that was my last coaching appointment as a handball coach, head coach of the national team, senior.
Well, with all that experience, with all your coaching experience, it's the perfect opportunity to ask one of the key questions that we always ask on the Training Science Podcast is, what is really your coaching philosophy? And, I also find it interesting that your PhD was with animal models and learning and stuff as well. And I'm imagining there might be something there. I don't want to put words in your mouth. And it is always difficult to articulate kind of a philosophy. But what do you like to see in other coaches and stuff that you're mentoring? And then again, if you can reflect on your own personal experience, when you would go into these new environments with these new sports, where do you start?
So in a way, I have to say that I'm still coaching because to me, managing is coaching. So I feel I didn't have a formal management education. I didn't do an MBA. I didn't do any management degree. My management experience comes from coaching people. And to me, when I look at my team now, I have a very large team that is also multicultural, multinational in a foreign environment. And to me, it's no different to when I was on the bench coaching a bunch of people. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get the best out of each player I have, and I'm trying to win a game, and I have to set the pace and the tactics on how we're going to win the game. And this is no different to what I do every day. I have to achieve certain goals for the organization, and I have to use my players to the best of their abilities. And, like in every team, you have the star player, you have the midfielder, you have the defender, you have the shy player, you have the young player, you have the experienced player. And so I have to play with this mix on a daily basis. In terms of philosophy, I was very fortunate to work with some fantastic coaches in my early career. I mean, one of the guys I worked with was Lino Červar, that won Olympics and World Championships with Croatia in handball. The guy was just incredible. what really got me about him is he was a student of the game. He was studying, researching. He was reading books about nutrition. He was reading books about physical preparation. He was reading books about how to train memory, how to teach people concepts. He was actually a language teacher. And what I found over the course of my career as a sports scientist supporting coaches is that the best coaches are the ones that are inquisitive. They are students of the game. They are open to other specialties to come in, and they respect expertise. And so it was always a pleasure to work with coaches like that because they are inquisitive, they are stimulating, they don't accept answers just the way they are, but they push you to try to find solutions. What I didn't enjoy, and you know, I don't want to portray the sports science career as something that is always nice and smells nice, is always wonderful, and it's amazing. There are also some bad apples out there. You know, there are some coaches that are just not good enough, and they are very firm in their ideas, and most of the times they are based on absolutely nothing whatsoever. But because they have a glimpse of success, then people think that they are the gods in a way, but it's pure accident most of the time. So I have to say that most of the coaches I've seen that have been successful are people that can teach something. And so coaches that were previous teachers were always quite good. And so for me, coaching is teaching. This is the philosophy. It's as simple as that. It's if you cannot teach somebody something and you cannot make them better, then you should question what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just love that. I agree entirely. I love everything in there. Like that, even today, you're, you know, in your position where you're managing, you're still trying to get the best out of each player that's on your team. I also was reflecting on your comment about being a student of the game or a student of the sport. And I even reflect on Joel Filio, a high-level triathlon coach. And he always said that about Simon Whitfield, who's a multi-medalist in the sport of triathlon that you train for now.
Yeah.
But he always said that, you know, Simon was a student of the sport. And I think that, yeah, excellence and consistent excellence really comes from just that. It's never enough, like continually to be inquisitive. And then the teaching aspect is just so... Yeah, it's so vital in all that we kind of do and being there with athlete and coach, right? So to be along for the ride and to learn together. That's I really love what you said there, Marco. So how do you take, with that philosophy kind of in mind, and I'm almost thinking Great Britain, back to your Great Britain years, it must have been so exciting because there's all this, you know, you're kind of in up here and you're in charge with all this resource that's coming into the mix. And how do you contribute to that machine that was all around you and all those things that were happening? And especially as the leader, that must have been really challenging.
I would say it was not about me at all. It's, you know, my role was to facilitate, make things happen and, you know, connect people. And we had there was a cohort of practitioners that we would kind of meet regularly or semi-regularly to look at things that were coming from science and say, okay, how would this work in this sport? Or should we try this or should we try that? And also because I had a very good knowledge of the academic environment in the UK, I was trying to marry up expertise that was sitting in academia or in industry with a need that a sport would have. And one or the other fantastic people I had the pleasure to work with in the UK was Scott Drawer. Scott was the head of innovation at UK Sport, which was effectively the funding agency. And I think the fact that we had a good relationship really helped making a lot of things happen. But also there were some really brilliant practitioners that were really open to share and engage on a variety of levels and try different things. So, you know, these things happen if you have a community of practice that is pushing and pointing the noses in the right direction. And I was very fortunate to be accepted into it as one of the few foreigners that were there. It's not easy to be a foreigner anywhere. You know, I speak a funny accent and I'm from elsewhere and I need to learn about the culture. So to be accepted to be part of it and then have a a leadership role, it took a lot of courage from my employers, which I will always be grateful for. But also, I have to say, the community was very welcoming, and it helped me doing my job. And everybody that knows me probably would say that I'm very passionate about what I do, and I work hard. Now, if I succeed or if I'm good at it is a different story, but I try. And that's what I did over the years then. What was really good there is for a few years also, the research councils started to have an interest in sport, which is very rare. And so we managed to convince them to invest in sports technology and sports performance research in the lead up to the London Games, which really made a big difference to many institutions and to many things that are happening now. And the last thing that I'm very proud of is that we established some development of young practitioners. And I can see now that all the young practitioners that came through over these years are now in leading roles in the UK. And I still bump into some of them around the world when I travel for either conferences or events. So it's good to see that there was some sort of knowledge legacy going after the Olympics. And there is few of the old guard that's still there, which is very good too.
18, just a quick break to tell you about something seriously special happening at HIT Science. Now, follow me here. No doubt you've learned, as we did, that short duration, all-out efforts depend on your ATP PC supply out to about 10 seconds, and then the next minute or so, performance is going to depend on your anaerobic capacity, your alactic and lactic systems, right? Wrong. That thinking is all false. And when we think in that old energetic way, it flaws our programming skills. The upper range of exercise intensity towards the all-out range needs to be considered and applied relative to one's anaerobic speed and power reserve. And when you don't, you'll get not only the programming wrong for the individual, but the loading wrong. Your session's going to be too hard for some, too easy for others. The good news is there's an easy fix with a better strategy, and this is all outlined for you in our new course titled The Science and Application of the Anaerobic Speed and Power Reserve. We have one of the pioneers in the era in Professor Peter Wan teaching us the scientific basis for the reserve. Grand Tour sports scientist and trainer Dio Saunders shows its application for cyclists, while our own Martin Bescheid details the application strategies for running and team sport athletes. And we're incredibly proud to bring you this course, and we promise it will blow your mind and raise your game as a sports scientist, coach, or practitioner. It's all available from the HIT Science website. So jump in now with 15% off the course price using coupon code ASR15 at checkout and take your programming skills to the next level. We look forward to seeing you in the course. And now, back to the podcast.
So where do you start with that, making those key vital relationships? And, you know, you just gave one example with Scott, right? But I'm sure there were hundreds that you had to make.
Yeah, there was tons. You know, I remember one, you know, Al Smith was the physiologist of the rowing team. The rowing team was incredibly successful in UK historically. And they were open to do a lot of things that we had a look at, you know, from training monitoring involving salivary hormones to trying to understand heart rate variability and planning why in certain moments of the year there were specific illnesses that were coming up. Or I remember when we started looking at warm-up strategies for the cycling team. There was Matt Parker was the head of innovation for the cycling team. Scott Gardner was there as well. And we had the 2 days, we were locked in with all the riders, the coaches, to try to look at ways to improve performance. And one of the conversations was around increasing muscle temperature in the legs of the riders and how we would go about it. And that's where the pants came up a few years later.
I remember those.
And one of my last experiments in Aberdeen was actually increasing muscle temperature passively. So I had my data about that. And I said, you know, this is how you can do it passively. And then we discussed a lot of things over 2 days, and then a few things were implemented. So it was really good to have this kind of open mindset. It was the same about, you know, doing some work with Danny Allcroft for preparing Amy Williams for her gold medal in skeleton in Vancouver, just looking at pre-activation, looking at what we could do in the day before the race and what we could do for the sprint on the race. And so to be part of those communities and then see an athlete achieving the gold medal at the Olympic Games is just incredible. I always say that we are we are in the business of emotions and in the business of people. So having the ability to be involved with these people and then making sure that the one talented person gets what they can get the maximum out of it is always a privilege. So I was privileged to be part of those groups and be part of the conversations.
Absolutely. That's so cool. I reflect on David Martin. It's, you know, he always talks about sport is emotion and you have to be part of that emotion. And sounds like you were thriving in that as well. I'm imagining you weren't getting too much sleep in those years as well. So
it was stressful, I have to say, in particular because the British press is always particularly keen in finding the wrong angles about what everybody's doing. But I have to say, I was the lightest I've ever been during the Summer Games. I don't know, stress probably has something to do with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned Scotty Gardner as well, legend. And we had him on the podcast. I'm not sure if you heard that one too, but it's, just so many, sounds like you just had so many good people around you. And there's amazing things can happen when you, when that energy kind of all gets together and everyone's on this, riding the same bus, right? And going in the same direction.
It was also good, I have to say, professionally, it was really good because first you're in a room where there's a lot of clever people that are more clever than you. And that's a good room to be in when you're sitting and you look at the people around and they know a lot more than you do. That's a good place to be.
Yeah.
And the second one was that because I was thrown challenges from everywhere, I had to learn quickly about stuff. So, you know, 1 week I would be dealing with how you cool down the horses in the equestrian team. And the next week I'm up with the alpine skiers in Zermatt. And then I come back. I'm in the ice rink with the short track speed skater. So you have to learn a lot of things quickly, and you have to pick up the vibes from the coaches and the athletes community really, really quickly to understand what's doable and what's not. At the same time, keep an eye on innovation and what universities want to do and all the kind of stuff, and keep the noise away and just bring in what can really add value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there would be no total. A bunch of decision-making going on with all of that. It's probably some disappointed individuals and some really excited individuals, but this is how we get to where moving the bus forward.
You know, one of the things I would like to say that probably this is going to stay in the podcast, you know, one of the biggest challenges going into the London Games was that, of course, every university in the UK was really keen to help the Olympic team, and they all thought they had a wonderful idea and their research was the only thing that was going to help the team win. The reality is that they didn't know what we were doing or what the teams were doing. And many times what the teams do is way more advanced than what research institutions think they are doing.
Totally.
And simply because federations and sports don't publish papers, that's not what they are there for. They are there to produce medals. They think nothing is happening and that's not the reality. Plus the other big issues that I found this in academia around the world in general. When I started, many of the people in academic institutions were also involved in sport. At the moment, most of the researchers that work in sport have never worked a minute in the real world. And therefore, they are totally unaware or naive about what can be really implemented in the real world, sometimes not even knowing the rules or the logistic peculiarities of dealing with a sport. I remember somebody having some ideas about warming up, improving warm-up outcomes, but that involved a lot of equipment that was not going to be feasible and practical to travel. And so no matter how good your research is, it just cannot be implemented. And I think this is one of the biggest risks now for young graduates. There's a lot of institutions that provide sports science degrees. I'm not sure who's teaching on them. And therefore, I'm not sure if they really prepare people for the real world. They probably prepare people for a lot of other things and they give them good skills for other things, but I'm not sure they prepare them for high performance sport.
Of course. Yeah. And I mean, we've spoken about this a number of occasions, done some posts on this, phrase it two worlds. And there's really these two silos that kind of exist, where there's academia and there's the sports science that's coming out in academia. And then there's the sport itself, just like you said, keeping things quite private, but it's not to say that that they're not doing their own N of one research to find out how their individuals are firing to get the most out of them. And quite the contrary, they're doing a lot. And it is sort of two worlds. And it's always a challenge to try to get those two worlds to speak to one another. Alan Hahn and the AIS were probably the first where they're doing these embedded PhD research projects that I had the privilege of being involved with. But, you know, and I would, reflecting on some of my students where they would, they'd come back and tell me that I really, oh no, we're way ahead of that, Paul, you know? And then I didn't really even see that myself until I was embedded in the sports in the New Zealand program as well. But you, until you actually get the privilege to jump into that sport, you know, what else do we really expect from academia? How can they really know? Because there's only a few privileged individuals that tend to get that info. And I don't know what the solution is, but it is very interesting.
Yeah, it's it's always a battle. And I think there is no solution. The solution is when you try to bring clever people into a room to solve a problem. And this is what worked for me when I was in the UK. Sometimes what works here is if you have a performance problem, then you try to bring in expertise to try to provide a solution. And sometimes if you bring the right people in and is a mix of expertise, then you can really find a practical solution that can be doable and can be implemented. Or sometimes you just go for a blue sky plan and you try it and it works or it doesn't work, but it takes time to get an answer.
Mm-hmm. I almost wonder if, maybe there might be some solutions. And I'm thinking in the problem of academic contribution to high-performance sport, coalface high-performance sport. Maybe technology is a potential solution. What if individuals within academia, I'm thinking artificial intelligence as well, right? If they're developing certain methods, maybe they're even only developed on, lesser trained individuals, but still potentially the methodologies might still be applicable in the high-performance context. I'm not sure if you have any thoughts there.
Yeah, I actually spoke about it recently in the IOC conference. We spoke about artificial intelligence in sport, what is happening, where are we going with it, and what's going on. I think one of the first few issues that we still have in sport is the quality of data. Okay, so the quality of data in many sports is not good enough to really make very simple inferences. Therefore, to think blue sky and think that machine learning is going to suddenly predict things based on really bad data, it's just wrong to assume. And I talked about the GIGO principle, garbage in, garbage out, this is a big issue in sport. The other thing that we should also realize is that we rarely have big data in sports. A lot of people talk about big data. There's not really big data. Even if when you look at the football team, you're talking about 25 players on a roster. That's not really big data in terms of their internal load and their characteristics. So predicting things like injuries and performance in a small group like that is a bit far-fetched. I think really the future is, if we really want to understand a few things, has to be in open AI solutions, whereby anonymized data go in, and there's a lot of good data that go in from different sources, and then we can start to really use AI to guide a few things. But there are, of course, applications that are likely to happen in some sports and very unlikely to happen in others. So in a sport like triathlon, cycling, where it is possible to really measure good quality data these days on every single training session the athlete is doing and some physiological monitoring and some other bits and bobs with very limited injuries, then it's probably possible to be a bit clever on how training prescription happens and how outcomes can be predicted. But in a sport like football, handball, basketball, figure skating, I cannot see short-term how things can really improve with AI unless the quality of data and the density of data improves. So this is the risk I see, which has also got an employment risk for practitioners, because if the powers to be decide that a software can substitute 3 or 4 practitioners, then sports science is really in trouble going forward. So we need to be really careful how these things are going. I think quality of data is the biggest issue at the moment to really advance AI.
Yeah, you're so right, and I agree with that. It's And again, you're probably aware we're working on this problem with Athletica. And again, we focus mostly on the sports of triathlon, cycling, running, moving into rowing now as well. But the GIGO principle is always comes up, and I've got a Trello ticket right here. And it's, you know, it's data quality. It's knowing when you've got bunk data versus, you know, good quality data. You've got to have safeguards on that because various different issues and happen. But I mean, that'll be a problem that someone can probably, tackle in the future, right?
I think big consortia are the future, you know. Big consortia, when people put together a lot of data together for the benefit of really advancing human science, that can really advance machine learning approaches and AI approaches to start to really make sense of some of the things that come in. But until then, until there is a community of intent, it's going to be very difficult for small groups to really get something meaningful out of data. So quality and frequency of data is key. And also the other thing that people need to be aware is AI is biased by the data you put in. So just to go, I go back to football teams because that's what they tend to do from time to time. But, you know, if your internal load, all you can measure is the session RPE, your data is biased. So AI is going to try to predict injury and performance on data that is heavily biased. So what's likely to be the outcome is going to be a useless outcome. So why do you even attempt that if that's the best you can do? So the people really need to be critical about quality and density of data.
Yeah. So we agree wholeheartedly, which is why, and again, my bias and my work is within Athletica, where we have a coach version as well, because we feel that you need to have that coach that's kind of along the side that's safeguarding and can identify when the data is bunk. And when the machine is saying something that goes against common sense, then you need to have that coach there. But at the same time, AI is starting to, at least in what we're seeing, AI is starting to be helpful in terms of showing identifying red flags and showing the coach when when things might want to be moved, loads up and down. But again, the coach is always still the driver in this. But it's kind of like the self-driving car. We can move it along, but we'd better still be there to kind of safeguard things in before the machine starts going off the road, right?
Look, the same is happening in the medical community. We are looking at AI, for example, to help clinicians to make differential diagnosis. So it's exactly the same thing. You know, you're presented with a variety of data. You have to make a diagnosis and a prognosis or an intervention. And AI is going to suggest you a bunch of things. You are the clinician. You have to make the call because that brings a legal element into it. So if an injury happens, who's responsible? Is it the AI machine or is it the clinician? Or is it the coach? So these are all ethical dilemmas that are coming up as we implement AI. But look, what's happening in sport is no different what's happening in the clinical world. So it's exactly the same.
Yeah, I agree entirely. Yeah, it's an exciting ride we're on. So maybe that was one of the things I wanted to sort of talk to you about is, again, you've explained your history and the evolution of sport science. You know, and again, let's think about, we want to give back to the practitioners of today that are, you know, listening to this podcast, and they might be in school, they might be studying. How can they go about preparing for the future that's in front of us right now?
I think even more, you know, when I started, I realized very quickly that understanding technology and using it was going to be my ticket into the high performance world. Of course, knowledge, you have to know what you're doing. I really want to make a point about this. There's been a plethora of emphases of courses and activities on soft skills. Like, this is great. It's brilliant. Of course, you need soft skills. You're working with other people. If you don't have soft skills, you can't work anywhere. You cannot work in a bank. You cannot work in a grocery shop. If you cannot relate and work with other people, you just cannot work in a team. This is as simple as that. But the emphasis should not be on soft skills, because at the end of the day, you go in high performance sport, you need to be knowledgeable about your staff, and it's not a given. So focus on knowledge. People should be knowledgeable. Then they should be able to work with other people, communicate things properly. So anything that you can learn about communication, working with others, but also having a multicultural approach. Nowadays, if you work in high performance sport, you are likely to work with practitioners from different parts of the world. You might have, if you are in football in the UK at the moment, your head coach is likely to be Spanish or from another country. Therefore, he is going to bring in a bunch of practitioners that speak his language. And can you speak Spanish? If you cannot speak Spanish and most of the crew around the head coach is Spanish speaking, you're going to be out of the loop on a lot of things. So understanding language and understanding communication is key. If you work with an elite tennis player, it might be he's from a country, the coach is from another country, his physiotherapist from another country, and you're working into a sport that is a sport that involves a lot of traveling. So understanding all these things is also quite important. And last but not least, of course, technology. If you really don't have a good understanding of technology nowadays, what is good technology, what is bad technology, what is valid, what is reliable, how you can extract data quickly, how can you use AI to accelerate your work so you can dedicate more hours to understand those numbers and implement things. This is key. I'm doing a course on AI in healthcare at the moment. And one of the things I'm trying to develop is, of course, some basic coding skills to do a few things. And I use AI to do some stuff. And it's amazing how much time it saves me. So it's a good thing to start to do. So what I would say to young practitioners studying is to focus on a lot of things, not only soft skills, which seems to be the hot thing now, or just learn how to use R. Because you can be very good at coding in R, but you have no understanding of physiology. You ain't going to be of much use in a high-performance sport if you are employed as a sports scientist.
Yeah, man. You got to tick a lot of boxes today to get in. And we just hired an incredible back-end developer, but he ticks all the boxes for us at Athletica. He's a triathlete. He's an ex-high-performance swimmer. He's a theoretical physicist. He does all the coding, but then he's got all the, and then when you meet him as well, he's just the nicest guy. So you really kind of today, who are getting the jobs, they really kind of have to have the complete package. So yeah, it's really, really interesting times.
It's highly competitive. So you need to have something that makes you different from everyone else. So what is it? It's probably a mix of things.
It probably is. It probably is. So I don't know where we go with this now, Marco. Tell us about your own triathlon training. What are you doing and why are you doing it?
Yeah, why I do it is a question I ask myself every day. No, I don't come from endurance sports, from an endurance background at all. You know, as I said, I was a handball player, and as every handball player, I hated with a passion preseason where we were doing a lot of runs without touching the ball for the first couple of weeks. So yeah. Now here I am running and cycling. No, I started because I did my MCL doing windsurfing. And so I bought a bike and started swimming again to do some rehab. And my wife and my son were doing triathlons. So I was the bike mechanic at events and the soigneur. And then I decided that since I was waking up early in the morning, I'd better do some exercise myself. And so I joined the Lycra crew. And in the last few years, my training has ramped up. And I did the 70.3 in December last year in Bahrain, which was my first 70.3. I was very happy about the time. So just like every age group triathlete, I struggle with the usual niggles and injuries from time to time, and trying to try to fit in three disciplines within a work-life balance. But it for me is a form of sanity to be able to exercise and be outdoor and do activities and be in a very nice community, which is the triathlon community here in Doha. It's just a brilliant thing to do, and also gives you a chance to try a few gizmos, you know, riding with the continuous glucose monitors and a few sensors here and there, you know, allows you to really see a few things and make your mind up about a few things that you read sometimes in the literature or things that you want to implement.
Tell us about your experience with your CGM. What continuous glucose monitor are you using and what have you discovered?
I use an Abbott one for about 15 days. For me, it was fascinating to see how my glycemia was changing with some food choices I was making. And so for me, it was an eye-opener. I now know which cereals to buy or not to buy, just based on my response. And it was really good to see that whatever I was doing on a bike, it was kind of working. So that reinforced some of the things that I was trying on. Fascinating. I think it's is a very promising technology, especially when integrated with other things. It can really change how people feed during long rides and long activities, but also how you make some food choices, especially if you are particularly responsive to some foods and you get big spikes in glycemia, it could definitely help.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I found it fascinating. For me, stress was the other one. You know, you mentioned you lost all that weight in when you were working on in Team GB. But I mean, that's for me, I can just always remember I was wearing my CGM working in New Zealand Olympic and I remember getting some bad emails sometimes just sitting on the couch there, right? And I glanced down and like my, you know, my glucose is just through the roof, like I've had a tasty sugar treat or something like that, right? And but it really highlighted my own individual response to stress. Of course, cortisol, a glucocorticoid, releases all that sugar, and what is that doing to my health? Hard to know, but it's potentially not good. So, what are some other means that I can, or strategies that I can kind of go about to work towards limiting that stress reaction that I'm having?
Yeah, it's fascinating now with all these technologies, really possible to all the things that we've been studying, it's possible to see some of these things on you. And I used to follow a website years ago, it was called Quantified Self, where people were reporting a lot of their self measures and things that people were doing to combat diabetes or increase physical activity or reduce weight. Fascinating insight. And you can really see the interplay. For example, for me, I measure my heart rate every morning. And I've been doing this for a number of years. So I can really see when things are going south, not only in terms of training, but especially when work-life balance gets a bit in the wrong direction or traveling. And so you need to learn how to adjust and adapt to all these things. It's fascinating. And I think in the future, we will move more and more towards this personalized healthcare approach where we can go to a practitioner and to a physician and say, look, this is the data for the last 2 months. I'm not feeling well. What do you think? And have that conversation as a patient.
Yeah, and that's a perfect segue to kind of move into another thing I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, what are some potential future devices that are kind of coming in here that you're seeing? And I'll start. We've spoken on the podcast before to others that are a bit in the know. We've spoken about continuous lactate monitors. We know that these are in kind of pilot phase, and people with that are embedded in these companies like Abbott, you mentioned, they're tinkering with these now. That will certainly be a fascinating one, I think. Is there anything else?
Hey there, training science enthusiasts. No doubt you'll be aware of Athletica AI, the AI training tool we've been working on since 2015 with the idea of creating an AI coach for endurance athletes using the HIIT Science training principles. We have adaptive training plans available for runners, cyclists, triathletes, and duathletes. You simply plug in your event, when it's going to occur, connect up your wearable, and crack on with your training, where you're going to get sessions that are going to adapt daily no matter what you do. This is available for both athletes that would rather self-coach, as well as coaches that want an assistant. Unlimited session variety with our workout wizard, invisible monitoring and zone updates with our power profile, alongside our latest tool, the workout reserve, which shows you how deep you've gone in any one session relative to the past. That's pretty important if you want to stay injury-free, maintaining training consistency, which we all know is the number one principle that leads to personal best outcomes. Just check out our blog for all the success stories. And now we're becoming truly AI innovative with GPT integration for session analysis. Mind-blowing. Remember that our coach platform is free alongside a free course coaches can take to learn how to leverage it to be better at your job and even to take on more athletes. So head on over to athletica.ai and trial for free for 2 weeks. If you like what you see, jump on board with our special year-end offer exclusive for podcast listeners of 25% off an annual athlete plan with the code YEARN25. That's only till the end of this year. That code again, all caps, no spaces, year end 25 at checkout. Look forward to seeing you there. And now back to the podcast.
Look, we've been tinkering with this in the lead up to the London Games in 2012, thanks to a very generous funding of the Engineering and Physical Research Council, as well as the BBSRC, with different groups. And we had some preliminary data. They were indwelling electrodes that were going through the skin, so small needles that were going in at the time to collect things in the epidermis. And I can tell it was a bit of a mess at the time. Of course, the quality of sensors and electronics is improved, and I'm a big fan of Professor Joe Wang's lab. The stuff he does with, you know, digital plasters and things that he can measure are just mind-blowing. But when these things will come and will become available, we will need to look at what it means, because of course we learn physiology from measuring lactate in blood or in a muscle, and what we measure on the skin might be a different thing. And is the same with CGMs, continuous glucose monitors. So I think we will need more data to understand what that actually means and how to use it to then change some of the interventions. But I can see these things really accelerating now, because the quality of the sensors is getting better and better. They're getting smaller and smaller. Just to give you some insight, hopefully we can publish this paper soon. We monitored some athletes during an ultra endurance event here in Qatar. It's an ultra endurance event of 200 kilometers called the Sambla, and it's a multi-sport ultra endurance event. And we measured a bunch of things live, you know, from speed, velocity, acceleration, core temperature, skin temperature, the whole lot that was possible. I can see a future whereby we will have mass events like a marathon, a race, or something like that, where there'll be live physiological data. And that's going to help us a lot, first understanding performance, but most of all to have medical teams on site to be able to provide better medical care to the participants in case something goes wrong. So I think what these companies are doing, and I hope they get to the market pretty soon with some good products, is not only going to help performance, but is actually going to help people making better choices about their lifestyle. And possibly for us working in sport to be better at customizing the interventions, which will be not only training related, but also nutrition related. When do you eat what, at what time when you do this type of activity? And this will really move towards personalized medicine.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. Amazing. Marco, yeah, I guess we've talked about the future. We've talked about advice for aspiring practitioners. We've talked about technology. Is there anything else that you think that we need to address here while we've got you and you've got the megaphone out to the practitioners in sports science and coaching?
I think it's the best thing is to always seek professional development opportunities. Try to see where you can learn what you need to learn in different fields that are relevant to you. And these things change. Well, I can tell you over time, my priorities changed on what I needed to learn and what I wanted to learn. So at the beginning of my career was a lot about physiology. Then it moved to learning some techniques to understand how the brain worked. You know, then I was working in sport, and for a while then I had to learn how to do how to extract data and do dashboards on Power BI. So, you know, things really move. At the moment, of course, the hot topic is AI, but look for opportunities, look for areas that can make you a better practitioner. I will make a quick plug on a new diploma, the IOC diploma in strength and conditioning that was just launched by Sports Oracle. And it's a very important one to me because the IOC diplomas were in mostly in medical and clinical areas. So there was an IOC diploma in sports medicine, an IOC diploma in sports nutrition, there's an IOC diploma in drugs in sport, in safeguarding. I think recognizing the recognition from the IOC that there is an importance in an IOC diploma in strength and conditioning is a big thing for this profession. So it's just been launched last week. So hopefully people will be interested in it. If not, of course, we will fold it. But I think there is interest, and we hope we can put together a program that can really help practitioners develop new skills. But, you know, there is other things. I use Coursera quite a lot for a lot of courses, and I find a lot of useful courses there. So my advice to the youngsters and is always to look for opportunities to learn. And then for others that are more or less my age, I still try to learn things. I'm doing a course at the moment on artificial intelligence in healthcare. So I'm learning about that. And there is always something to learn somewhere. So never stop learning is the key message, I guess.
Well, that's a perfect place to leave it, I think, Marco. So we will definitely link to the IOC S&C course that's just been launched, diploma that's just been launched. And congratulations to you. I know Inigo Mujica is involved in that as well. So, and many, many others, high-profile practitioners. You know, and again, Marco, just really grateful for you and the career you've led and continue to lead, and the fact that you are never stop learning, and even from a practical standpoint, getting into, we learn by doing, right? And I'm sure that you can even continue to learn by doing your triathlon training and hooking yourself up to all the various different fun technologies. And isn't it kind of fun to tinker with these sorts of devices, right? Whatever's kind of coming into the market, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I love tech, so I had to end up doing triathlons, of course. We love our gadgets, and my age is all about looking good on the pictures, forget performance.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. Ego's strong in all of us, isn't it?
Exactly.
Marco, that was absolutely fantastic. On behalf of Martin and the whole Hit Science team, we're grateful for you and look forward to what you're going to be doing still for the future.
Thank you very much. It was great to have this conversation.
Cheers, Marco.
Hey there, Training Science enthusiasts. If you like what you just heard, be sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hit Science to keep up with our latest. And if you want to take your knowledge to the next level, visit our website to check out our full online course and textbook on the science and application of high-intensity interval training. Now, if you're a university, club, or sports organization, we've got special packages available for you and your team. Just contact us at info@hitscience.com. And if you want to join our evolution as a field and take your application even further, be sure to check out the Hit Science technology platform, Athletica. Visit athletica.ai or follow us on Instagram and Twitter @athletica_AI. Thanks for listening.